EWA-517, do you want to report a UFO?
Negative. We don't want to report.
Ares 31, do you wish to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We won't report one of those either.
Ares 31, do you wish to file a report of any kind? Over.
I wouldn't know what kind of report to file, sir.
Ares 31, me neither.
There 71 Papa Golf, go ahead.
And was there anybody at above us that passed us like 30 seconds ago?
There 71 Papa Golf, negative.
Okay. Stop this. It's a UFO.
Yeah. Hey, it's Merger 1095. Yeah, something just passed over. Don't know what it was, but it's at least 2,000-3,000 feet above us. Yeah, it passed right over the top of us.
911.
You guys busy? You would just call about the UFOs that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
They're out there, taking airplanes.
Howdy, dispatch.
Okay.
Bob, I swear to God, 4 calls in on an unidentified object over Liberty.
4 calls?
4 calls on an unidentified flying object.
All right, Bob, take a look. All right, we'll check it out.
Welcome to UFO Chronicles, a place where people share their experiences of the strange and unexplained. If you've had an encounter and would like to be on the show, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com. Hello and welcome to the show, everyone, wherever in the world you are joining us from tonight. We have Daniel from San Francisco coming on the moment with his near-death experience. And if you've had an encounter and you would like to come on and share it on the podcast, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com or via the contact page on my website, ufochroniclespodcast.com. If you enjoy the show and you would like to help support the podcast on Patreon, you can do this for as little as $1 a month. Head on over to www.patreon.com/UFO Chronicles Podcast. You can also find a link in the description of this episode below. Any help is very much appreciated. Now, on with the show. Daniel.
Thank you, Nick. It's good to be here.
Thank you for coming on the show, and you're all the way from San Francisco.
Yeah, that's right. I've been here for about 20 years.
Great stuff. And you have a near-death experience to share with us today.
I do. It started, I guess, well, the near-death experience itself was in 2016. That's about a little over four and a half years ago now. It was in April. I'll give you a little bit of the lead up to it and then describe the experience itself. So I had a very unhealthy lifestyle leading up to the event, and it really took its toll on me physically, and it really took its toll on me emotionally, I guess, as well. There was a lot of addiction in my story, and just poor life choices all around. You know, I think these days, I would say that around about 2015, I pulled what I would now call the tower card, and my life just kind of collapsed. Within a span of that year, my dog died, my sister died, my wife left, my job evaporated, and so suddenly I was left alone with just this addiction. And you know, so I was pretty well resigned to that. This was just going to be the slow descent. And I don't want to say I was okay with it, but I was resigned to it at the time. The universe, it turns out, had much different plans for me. So as I said, in April 2016, things had bottomed out. My health was really, really going. I was losing my eyesight, and wasn't taking food as I should, and so on. I was quite sickly. And a friend who I hadn't seen in about a year came for a just relatively surprised visit. And he took one look at me and said, more or less, you know, we're going to the emergency room right now. So I did my best to get up and go, and I assumed they were going to turn me right back around, say, look, fool, you know, cut the shenanigans out, clean up your act, you know why you're here, and send me packing. But that isn't at all what wound up happening. The last thing I remember after they drew blood there was the ER doctor telling me that he'd never seen somebody with a sodium level as low as mine walking and talking, that I should, by all rights, should have already been far unconscious. That's the last thing I remember. And he said, we're going to the ICU right now. And that's literally the last thing I remember of the material world for a number of days. I slipped into a bit of a coma, and my sister, who is my closest family, and my then ex-wife were being told, get his affairs in order. He was on his way out. He wouldn't have survived another 24 hours in the wild, so to speak. And now that we've got him, really all we can do is make him comfortable. So I was not expected to make it out. So I laid in that hospital bed for 3 going on 4 days. And that's, you know, from outward appearances, that's what happened. But I was having a very, very different experience. It's difficult to recount. It's quite emotional. And it doesn't lend itself to really a narrative very well. Maybe what I can say up front is I can tell you what it wasn't. You know, with a lot of near-death experiences, you hear about seeing the white light and having a conversation with whatever holy being appears for the person, and having a conversation about, you know, reviewing their life and making a decision about whether they're going to come back. And that's not the experience that I had at all. Or not precisely anyway. I guess I should even say not the parts I'm allowed to remember, not the parts that I was sent back with. What I do remember quite vividly was being cared for by a number of beings who were really, I think, mostly focused on keeping me in my body. I very much wanted to go. I don't know that I wanted to go so much as it just felt easy to go. And that was not what was in the cards for me. They encouraged me to stay in my body, and to they said that it was a decision that had been made, that I had made the decision that I was going to go back, and this was all a necessary component of what was to come, that I had an agreement that I'd made not only with myself but with my young daughter, who at the time, I guess she would have been 4. And I was good with that. You know, I don't want, when I say they had to keep me in my body, it wasn't as if I was trying to leave or wanted to leave. It wasn't like that. It was like a necessary component of a healing. You know, think of it as like, I don't know. They just had to anchor me there. The first place, and I give you this caveat or this qualifier up front, that I can only describe this in the ways that my brain and my memory have kind of had to shape things to make sense of it for me to even be able to put it into words. So I don't believe that I literally was in these places. I believe that my brain had to take the images that I had and the experiences that I had and shape them into something that made sense to the material world that I was going to return to and that I knew prior. But the first place that I remembered being was in it was kind of a witch doctor's tent, for lack of a better phrase. The walls and the ceilings were all dark brown, dark tan, maybe made out of some sort of an animal hide. I'm not really sure. And I was laying on these like a small cot near the floor. There were candles all around, dirt floor, very, very rustic. There was no technology in this place, I guess you could say. And I was tended to by a very rotund, dark-skinned woman, I think. Although the gender didn't really come up. I was still very, I was leaving my body a lot at that point. And she would come and my head and my feet guide me back in. And she would speak to me a little bit, although I'd have no recollection of what she would say. But it was reassuring words to keep me there. to keep me in my body. And floating throughout this whole scene, I don't know how else to describe them, but they were like energetic jellyfish. They were white, blue, electric in color around their perimeters, but they really didn't have much form, so to speak. And they were brilliant, the lights. They're brilliant lights. And there were hundreds, at least, of them. And they would float in and out, and some would come in a great, it's not what I was experiencing at the time, but they would come and become kind of one with me. And I would come to later understand that these were experiences and wisdoms that were making themselves available, offering themselves to me for what I was to return and do. And they actually stuck with me for a while, even after I came back to the material world, came fully back into my body and was present here. So that was the first stop. And that lasted, honestly, I have no way of knowing. It could have been 15 seconds, or it could have been almost the entirety of the 3.5 days. There really wasn't any measure of time that I could recollect or make sense of. But as I was tended to, and I came to kind of understand what it was happening to me a bit, as much as you can understand anything in that state, I was being brought closer back to my body, to my actual physical body. And this appeared to me as more of a wartime tent. It felt like maybe something in the World War II, South Pacific, although I think maybe I watched too much MASH as a kid. But that's kind of what it felt like to me at the time. And I was attended to there by a very, very large and androgynous being, albino actually is what I would call it here. No color to the skin or hair, no gender to speak of. They just kind of tended to me, and they would speak to me from time to time and encourage me to stay and to get ready for what was coming. They gave me what appeared to be I know this sounds ridiculous, but I can only report what happened to me. I can only report my experience, and this is my truth. They gave me a what looked like a small, like 1950s style television. One of those like 10 or 11 inch TVs. And they sat it next to where I was positioned and told me that this is how I could view what was happening in the quote unquote real world, in the world that you and I are talking in right now, Nick. And most of the time it was just static. I couldn't actually see much, black and white screen. But every once in a while I would get a glimpse of somebody entering the space that I was in. Sometimes it'd be a friend or a family member, but I wasn't able to really watch, minute to minute what was happening. It was more of a general gist, enough for me to say, oh, my sister just entered. And then it would go back to static. And that was kind of my experience on the full on other side when I was there. Was being tended to by these two beings to be prepared to be brought back into the physical world. I was informed as a part of my return and a part of the agreement that there would be some drastic lifestyle changes made. And of course, I agreed to those readily. It's not like I was living lifestyles of the rich and famous prior to that. But they were pretty drastic, not at all what I would have hoped for or expected. It was that I was going to turn my life over to service and that I would be gifted with hearing or being in receipt of these kind of higher wisdoms and to go embody that. And as a part of that was really bring my daughter along and make sure that she had a proper upbringing, that she could be made aware of how much more there is to life, the universe, and everything than chasing dollars and what's on YouTube and how many likes you get, all the sorts of traps that we fall into in the material world. And I was quite ecstatic to fulfill that latter part of that. And I didn't really understand what the first part meant. To be in receipt of higher wisdom. I didn't know what that meant. I had no idea. Prior to all of this and prior to the rapid decline of my health. I worked as a technology executive in and around Silicon Valley, San Francisco, for decades. And that was my world. It was very systematic. I was a software engineer prior to that. It was very much about climbing the corporate ladder and making the money and having the stuff. And, you know, that was my measure of success. And by those counts, I'd done it. But, you know, you see where that landed me. And there was no satisfaction there. So I was eager to get back in and at the very least be a good dad. You know, that would have been enough. I was given a second chance, and not many people get those. So I slowly kind of came to after that, much to the surprise of everybody. And I was delighted to find out, and quite actually astonished to find that I was surrounded by loved ones. My aunt had flown in from Michigan. My father had flown in from Michigan. My sister and her husband were there. My ex-wife was there frequently, many friends. I was very well attended, which was a shock to me. I didn't think at the time that I had been worthy of that. So my first impression coming out was just, I was very pleasantly shocked by the amount of love I was receiving, you know, and by just the outpouring of it. And of course, all the people that were there, all my loved ones, were quite concerned, to say the least. But at that point, I knew everything was okay. There was no fear anymore. It's like I had come out the other side, and I knew life was going to be radically different from then on. And I was eager to get on with it. But I had to first heal my body. I had to learn to walk again. At the time, they thought I was going to need a liver transplant. I guess I should have said that earlier. What was happening was my liver was failing. So I had to go through a period of intense inner and outer work, but outside of any life that I would have conceived of before. And I count that as a huge blessing now, that I wasn't able to get up off of the hospital, out of the hospital bed, and just, you know, go about business, because it really gave me over a year to realign my priorities, to understand what had happened to me, and to feed this new impulsion. It was not like a compulsion. It wasn't like somebody was telling me I had to do these things, but I just inwardly felt compelled to go study spirituality, to really look inward, to really, really look inward, and to reevaluate where my place was in the universe. And not just my place, but how the universe actually operates, because it had just been completely turned on its head. And so that's what I did. Relatively shortly thereafter, I began to notice that the memories that I had from the time before felt very different. It was almost like I was, when I'd recall things from before, especially from the years leading up to the event, they seemed like I was watching a movie. I don't know if you're familiar with the 1950s trope of the smell-o-vision. You know, people would go to the movies and they would pump in smells to add to the ambience of the movie. And it was like that, but instead of just smells, it was emotions. It was the whole gamut of the experience. But somehow I knew, or I felt, that they didn't belong to me. They were mine, but they weren't of me, if that made sense. I really had been completely remade over the course of these 3 days. I started realizing I knew things that I had no way of knowing. I understood things that would have not just baffled me before, but would have just had no place in my reality whatsoever. Things about the nature of the universe, the nature of divinity. You know, I to this day I hesitate to use the word God because of the negative connotations that our society places on it, but the nature of something much bigger than what we walk around experiencing in our day-to-day life. I guess it was a few months into my rehabilitation that I started to hear a voice very quietly at first, and it would just, at first I thought it was my conscience. It would tell me things that were the right thing to do. You know, it just kind of always had the right answer. It even got so silly that I could like ask it where my car keys were, you know, and it would respond. But mostly it was, you know, about doing the right thing. It was my kind of very quiet Jiminy Cricket.
Are you intrigued by Paranormal Talk Radio? You'll love the new Paranormal Radio app from TalkStream Live. You'll find a great selection of talk shows covering UFOs, ghosts, strange phenomena, and much more. Download the Paranormal Radio app now and start listening to the very best in paranormal talk entertainment, including the network you're listening to right now, the Paranormal Radio app, free in Google Play and the iOS App Store.
And shortly thereafter, I explored this a bit, and I discovered I could have conversations with it. And it took a little while before I gave in to the idea. And I got past the resistance to the fact that I was talking to my guides, to my guide at the time. It wasn't a huge stretch beyond that before I started, you know, giving it voice and letting it speak. And I would, you know, do my best to get it transcribed or to let someone else hear it. And invariably the messages were well beyond what my personality or my finite intelligence could come up with. I like to think I'm clever, but I'm nowhere near that clever. And it just always had the most loving, encouraging words. It was just beautiful at the time. And it was unlike anything I'd ever experienced. I'd never heard of channeling at the time. I didn't know what it was. My experiences before that with mediumship were like that John Edwards show that was on TV years and years ago, which is a far cry from what was happening. But I gave myself to it as a part of this new pursuit. And it was quite wonderful. And in the years since, I've kind of integrated that a bit. And the relationship with my guides has become much more personal and integrated, I guess. You know, I rarely will sit down and do a channeling session to give them voice. They inform me after a spell that, you know, these are really parlor tricks. And the real meat of what's happening here is the acceptance of the wisdom that's coming forward. And so I've really let go and surrendered to it. And my life has just changed in ways I can't I can't begin to describe. On the surface, everything looks great. I didn't wind up needing that transplant. They called it a miracle healing. By all accounts, when I get my blood taken, even back then, but you know, today, it looks like I look like a normal person. Maybe one that takes a little bit of Tylenol, I think is what my doctor jokes. So the liver is completely healed, doing its thing. My body is healthier and stronger than it has ever been in my entire life. I've reunited with my wife. I like to think I'm a super dad to my little girl who's now 9. She just turned 9, and she's my best friend in the world. I was able to take this new service orientation, this new openness, this new awareness. And that's one thing I haven't even spoken about, is just the hyper awareness that comes with all of this, of everything that's happening. But I've been able to take that into every aspect of my life. I've found a new career that allows me to use my skills, the skills I learned in my days in Silicon Valley, and to use them in service to children. I couldn't have fathomed of that before. It didn't make any sense. There's nowhere to climb, you know. The money is not what it once was, but that doesn't even register as something that matters. I can honestly say, after all this time, that despite the appearance that I almost died, and I had to spend a year learning to walk again, and not to even bring too much mention of the horrific depression that led up to it, the dark night of the soul that preceded it. All these things that on the surface seem like such a negative confluence of events, I can honestly say today that they're the best things that ever happened to me. I am so immeasurably grateful for every experience that I've ever had, but that led up to those events. And that gratitude just grows each and every day as I continue to walk this path of service. I've gone on to become a Reiki master teacher, a yogic meditation teacher as well. And I just spend my time trying to find ways to be useful, trying to find ways to be helpful to people. And it's such just a satisfying existence. I before I went into the hospital, I wanted to die. You know, it was a bit of suicide on the installment plan. And I can honestly say that today I wake up pretty much every single morning wanting to live for hundreds of years. You know, if and when I go, I'll go with the knowledge that because of this awakening, because of those events, I've lived a life well. I've seen things that many don't have the opportunity to see. I've experienced things that many don't have the opportunity to experience. And I think I do my best to turn those experiences into something positive for everybody that I encounter.
In some respects, it was a spiritual intervention for your addiction.
I think it absolutely was on one level. I tend to believe these days that this was the entire arc of events was probably something that was orchestrated at a much higher level, you know, well before I was born into this world. But at a certain level, it was absolutely a spiritual intervention that brought me back and really turned me around in ways that were just incomprehensible. That's the only word I have, you know. But before, I don't want to say that there was no hope, because that implies the existence of hope and that there's now a lack of it. The kind of hope that I carry around today, it didn't exist for me before. It wasn't a lack of it. It just had never been. And I think I needed to hit that nadir. I needed to have that deep, dark bottom so that I could, you know, gain the heights that I'm striving, that I strive for every day today. Absolutely a spiritual intervention. Yes.
So things had to get hit rock bottom before they, you know, before they got better.
I think so. You know, if we talk about things in terms of frequency, you know, you picture an energy wave or a sound wave, the amplitude of that is equal measures high and low, right? And for whatever reason, I chose the path, or at least I experienced the path of going very, very low so that I could get very, very high. And I'm very, very glad that I did.
And the benefit of all this is that you're now very active in recovery circles.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. A huge part of my life today. I look in recovery circles, and I need to pick my words very carefully here due to the nature of the program that I work. But I look at the folks that I meet in those circles who maybe haven't had as drastic of an experience as I did, but are just as desperate to turn their lives around. And these are some of the most loving, open people when they give themselves a chance to be. There's just immense potential in every single one of them to bring great light to the world for exactly the reasons that I described in myself. They've experienced the depths, and as a result, they know what it means to be grateful for every day that they have above ground, and have above ground with a clear head. Many of them also turn to service in one form or another. So it's immensely gratifying to help pull people out of that darkness. You know, I personally can't claim any credit for it. This is, I'm just a vessel, but it's a wonderful thing to see when you see that light go on in somebody that's been dimmed by chemicals or abuse for so many years, to just see their light turn on. There's really nothing quite like it in the world.
And being a Reiki master, do you have a website? Maybe people would want to get in contact with you.
Oh, certainly, yeah. Thank you for asking. My website is danielsteven.org, just like it sounds, S-T-E-V-E-N.
That's www.danielsteven.org.
Correct. And thank you, sir.
What advice would you having gone through everything that you did, what advice would you have for someone dealing with addiction out there?
For someone dealing with addiction, well, the first thing, the first piece of advice would be that they don't have to do that anymore. That there is another way, and the other ways is quite wonderful. Life is to be lived, and life is as beautiful or as horrific as you make it. And there's always a choice how you get to, how you experience yourself in this world. There's always a choice. So that would be the first piece of advice. And I suppose the second piece of advice would be, don't give up on yourself. Nobody is beyond redemption. Nobody. Those would be the first two things that I would say. I guess lastly, I would say they have to really want it, because it's hard. It's hard at first, but yeah, it's very, very worth it. Very, very worth it.
That's great, Daniel. I mean, even though it's not really the subject of the show, it's something which a lot of people deal with.
And I think a lot of people deal with it in very quiet, unhealthy ways. There's huge stigma attached to it, and people are afraid to talk about it of themselves or of family members or of friends who could desperately use help but are afraid to ask for it because of that stigma. You know, by the time somebody has reached out and is in any sort of a recovery circle, they've turned a corner of some sort, be it by making the decision that they want to clean up and see what life is actually like. Or, you know, many of them have been court ordered or something of that nature as well. But there are just as many, there are more, I'm sure, people who you don't leave their living room, you know, or are out on the streets and unable to get the help that they need. Or unlike me, I wouldn't be here had it not been for the intervention, the spiritual intervention and I was going to call it lucky, but I think it had nothing to do with luck, but with the appearance of my friend who just happened to be in town that weekend and just happened to come in. You know, I had less than 24 hours to live. So I think a lot of people suffer through the disease of addiction needlessly. And that's something that I would love to see change. That stigma doesn't do anybody any good. And quite frankly, it's so much wasted potential, human potential, that it's just lost because it's something we as a society try to sweep under the rug. So yeah, it's a very sad story, honestly, yeah.
Of course, because addiction comes in many forms, isn't it?
Oh, it does. Yeah, there's drugs, alcohol, the big two. But there's also sexual addiction, gambling addiction. Cigarettes are still a big player. Just anything that can gain a foothold in your life and gain control over you could be said to be an addiction of some sort. You know, I think speaking on that subject just a tiny bit. We're a society built in many ways around addiction to support addiction, but that then stigmatizes itself in that way. You know, this is a very consumer-driven society, at least in America. I think all of Western civilization, but that we live in. We become convinced that if we just get one more of whatever it is, you know, if I can place one more bet, if I just get the next year's model car, or if I just get the bigger house, or if I just get the next hit of heroin, whatever it happens to be for you, that somehow will be complete, that somehow will be fixed. And that's really, I think, the biggest step that people can take. And this is what was made clear to me as I came out of the other side, is that you're already complete. Everything you need is already in you. And it's the looking outward for that satisfaction that's keeping you from it. So yeah, it's a very sick cycle. It really, really is.
Yeah, no matter what people have, they always want something more, something extra.
Yeah, more. The disease of more. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's wonderful, Daniel. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your experiences. It has been fascinating.
Oh, thank you, sir. Nick, it's been a real pleasure. And thank you for inviting me to do this. This is the first time I've done anything like this, and you've made it a real pleasant experience, so I appreciate you.
That is all for today. Keep updated with the show. You can follow on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and on our website, ufochroniclespodcast.com, where you can find past episodes, the merchandise store, and some other cool features. Thank you to our guest, Daniel. And if you've been affected by addiction, do not be afraid to reach out. We all need a little help sometimes. I have left links in the description of this episode below, but feel free to email me and I will point you in the right direction. You are not alone. Thank you very much for listening. I will be back next week. Till then, stay safe and keep watching the skies. Goodbye.